You're listening to Energy Insiders, a weekly update on clean energy and climate policy with Renew Economies editor Giles Parkinson and leading energy analyst David Leach. Energy Insiders is brought to you by Evergen, providing cutting-edge energy management software for battery optimization, virtual power plants and distributed energy resources. And Pylon, helping solar installers and retailers design high-resolution solar proposals in minutes.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Energy Insiders podcast. My name is Giles Parkinson. I'm the editor of Renew Economy and its associated website, The Driven, the EV focus, The Driven, and One Step Off the Grid. And joining me as usual is ITK principal David Leach. David, I trust you are well and not stocking up too much on Easter eggs and hot cross buns.
Giles, I am well. I trust all our listeners are well, and we're getting to the end of what's been a very humid, high dew point summer, and so that's a good thing, and there's plenty of news to talk about as well.
Look, there is. Yeah, there is. I wanted to talk about hot cross buns. You want to talk about dew points, but let's get back to the energy market. Look, we've got an interesting interview coming up with a couple of digital and emerging technology experts from Monash University, and that's pretty interesting in the context of consumer energy resources and things going behind the meter and the utilities wanting it to come into the home and some of the other associated things with the rollout of large-scale renewables. But David, I just thought we might just touch off on the couple of the news of the week. I thought before that, I'm not too sure what's grabbed your attention, but today, this is Tuesday, March the 19th, when we're recording this, the default market offer, at least the draft recommendations from the Australian Energy Regulator have come out. And look, a fall in prices for most people, but I think some of the consumer groups are thinking the fall should have been bigger, given the sharp rise last year with the rise in wholesale prices and the quite large falls this year, and as you've often pointed out, the falls in future energy prices. Do you have any instant observations?
I've got two. The first is that in regards to the power price, it's a very lagging and smoothed out kind of effect. So the power price that AGL actually charges, for instance, or Origin, reflects 2 or 3 years of history during which time they've bought the power that they're selling today. They buy forward. That's point one. And that will probably continue to drift down as new supply comes on stream, but it's subject to whatever decision the New South Wales government might make about coal prices, for instance. And also what happens to Eraring in the short term. The other thing about it is that, you know, let's call it, say, 40%, and it might be 30 1 year and 50 another year, but 40% or more of the price paid by households represents grid charges, wires and poles. And they've gone up significantly this year, offsetting the fall in the wholesale price. And one of the things we don't talk about often enough is that all this rooftop solar and now increasingly home batteries basically means that the wires and poles, the energy going through it to households is not as high as it otherwise would be. And as a result of, but the wires and poles companies still need the same amount of revenue each year, so that if the volume falls, then the unit cost has to go up. That's a kind of complicated thing, and it's also another thing is that because our population has been growing so quickly, it's kind of been an offsetting influence. If you put 10% more people into a particular grid franchise, then that'll offset the fact that each individual household is on average consuming less. And just to finish on that topic, it could still be, like a couple of years ago, it was the case that in California, they paid much more per households per megawatt hour than, say, in Texas, but they actually had lower bills because they consumed less and the price worked that way. Energy efficiency worked. But the other side of it, of this grid charges, is that effectively all the people that don't have solar ending up paying a bigger share of the grid cost proportionately than the people who do have solar, because the people who do have solar only really have to pay mostly for the fixed cost of being connected to the grid, and that's not very big. Whereas the people who don't have solar, and that's often the poorer people, the renters, the people who live in units, let's be honest, they're the people who have to pay for a bigger and bigger share of the grid. And so there's some things that need to be fixed in that longer term. Gee, that was a long speech for a very small announcement.
Well, I wasn't expecting that at all. But look, I'm interesting on that point. The Power to the People thing campaign was launched this week in Parliament, which is Rewiring Australia. Saul Griffiths and co. They sort of proposed a scheme and just sort of underlined the need to make sure that people in apartments and renters get access to solar, so they too can share in the relief of from power prices and get some of the opportunity to lower their bills. I mean, I was just thinking in the rentals. I mean, I know my kids in Sydney rent as well and sort of suffer from you know, the lack of air conditioning and the lack of any sort of ventilation and things like that. And I saw a story about temperatures in rental prices in rental homes being 3 degrees above average than they were elsewhere. So anyway.
This is an ongoing problem, right? If volumes don't grow through the wires and poles, but the costs of running the network go up, then we're going to have to pay more per megawatt hour for those grid services. And we can't do without the wires and poles, but I do think there's a more fundamental rethink coming down the track. But hey, we've got so many other problems, Giles, we've got to solve before the end of this podcast. Maybe we'll leave that for another time.
Look, we might. Look, I think we might just hop straight onto our interview. What do you think? And we can come back and maybe sort of round up some of the other things that we've forgotten to talk about now in our introduction. This is an interview we did last week, and it's a pretty interesting one. It's with Yolande Stringers, who's the Professor of Digital Technology and Society at Monash University, and Kari Dahlgren, who's a researcher in the Emerging Technologies Research Lab at Monash University. And they've had a look at some of the issues of social license and all the stuff that goes with that, and particularly about the sort of the energy transition and how people should be engaged with. Anyway, let's have a listen to the interview. So, Yolande and Kari, thanks very much for joining the Energy Insiders podcast. Yolande, perhaps you'd like to introduce yourself first to our listeners.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having us. So I'm a professor in the Emerging Technologies Research Lab at Monash University. I'm also a digital sociologist, and I have a bit of a foot in human-computer interaction design as well. So that's a lot to get your head around. But I've been working in the energy sector for a couple of decades now, and really focused on understanding how people are approaching the future, what their expectations and needs are around the future energy system, and their reactions and interest and, you know, opportunities around all sorts of energy technologies and demand response initiatives that are being proposed.
Well, that, to look forward very much to getting into the detail of that. Kari, can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Yep. I'm Dr. Kari Dahlgren. I'm a research fellow in the same lab as Yolande, the Emerging Technologies Research Lab at Monash. And I'm an anthropologist. So I do research on various aspects of the energy transition, focusing on a lot of the social dynamics of change, how people understand and enact change. So really looking at that kind of everyday level of how these broader societal transitions happen.
Mm. So, Yolande, let's go to you first. Look, social license is a word that's sort of thrown around quite a lot now. We've had Peter Dutton talking about it and his big nuclear plans. We've had a lot of discussion about so-called social license in the building of transmission lines and large-scale wind and solar farms and the nature of the transition itself. You don't often hear about it in terms of consumer energy resources, so things that people have in their own home, like sort of rooftop solar, batteries, EVs, and then sort of the appliances that they may electrify. But you've kind of honed in onto this because this is kind of almost about sort of power and permission and license. We've already seen, I guess, with the construction of various virtual power plants that people are quite surprised, I guess, to sort of discover that they don't actually get to control all that much of their own goods, if you like, or the things inside their home. So maybe you can just sort of help us sort of land on this subject somehow by sort of some overriding observations about the sort of dynamics happening in this particular thing, but this particular part of the energy transition.
Yeah, sure, no problem. So, I mean, over the last sort of 4 years or so, we've been working on a Australian Research Council project called Digital Energy Futures with our partners Ausgrid, AusNet Services and Energy Consumers Australia. And one of the big questions with that project was how are people going to live in the future, and how are they going to, in that future, you know, respond and relate to all of the things that are expected from the energy transition side about their involvement in that transition. And one of the key, visions from the energy sector side is that people will increasingly allow energy companies of various types to automate or to control the energy resources in their home and also a range of other appliances in their home on their behalf to maximise the operation of the grid and, you know, ensure efficiency and all that kind of thing. And there may be some incentives thrown in there as well, which are being kind of proposed at the moment. But the central premise is that we will allow for this automation to occur.
Will we do that happily, or will we sort of kind of feel this is inevitable?
Well, I think the assumption that we've seen from the energy sector side is that, yes, that will be a relatively kind of happily handed over thing with the right incentives. You know, I think the energy sector is very focused right now on how can it incentivize people to allow this automation to occur. And
we'll give you a tariff and you shall obey.
Yes, more or less. Yeah, that's definitely the guiding principle at the moment. I mean, we've sort of, one of our pieces of work has been kind of really pulling apart all the assumptions that are embedded into energy visions and scenarios. And this one of handing over automation is just such a central one to realising the energy transition the way it's kind of currently set up. What our research has shown, so maybe I should just talk a little bit about what we actually do with people. Would that be helpful in terms of the research that we do? So we actually do quite in-depth ethnographic work with households, which means that we engage them. It's a qualitative technique where you really try and understand people's lived experience, and you kind of go into their lives, you do tours with them, you get them to do activities with you, you do interviews, a whole range of things. And you get a bigger sense about how their lives are changing and what's important to them than if you just ask them a bunch of questions about energy. So you get a much richer perspective. And also in our lab, we've been developing these future-focused methods, which place people in different scenarios and, you know, put different possibilities in front of them, ask them to design different technologies they might want to use, activities like that. And that gives us a sense of how they, you know, what kinds of priorities they might have in the future, what their needs and expectations might be. And then we put that together with a whole lot of other evidence that's sort of floating around, like what the broader technology sector thinks is going to happen and what the climate change predictions say is going to happen, and also of course what the energy sector expects is going to happen. And we place that into sort of future situations, like let's see what that looks like in 2030, let's see what that looks like in 2050. And that helps give us a sense of whether automation, handing over that automation, is really a realistic prospect for people given all the other things that they expect are going to change in their lives and the priorities that they might have. So just to kind of, I guess, make that a little bit more concrete, you know, in one of our, one of the future scenarios we've developed through Digital Energy Futures, we anticipate what we call the override peak in automation, which sort of occurs when we have extreme weather events or other circumstances which mean that people feel they need to override the automation of all of their energy resources and, you know, charge up their EVs, charge up all their batteries, charge up everything that's electrically powered in the home, and remove that kind of control on behalf of the energy companies, which creates this peak in the system. So it's kind of a new, problem, future problem to be considering that arises because automation isn't guaranteed, particularly in these, you know, really challenging circumstances.
And I guess it must come down to trust as well, because I guess the traditional story of the utility is that they basically sort of, you know, they came to a meter box outside your home and that's it, and then they send a bill inside your home every 3 months, but now they want to be inside your home all the time because they've got smart meters and smart controls and you've got stuff that they'd like to control and operate and draw down on and use that. Kari, I don't know whether this is an opportunity for you to sort of come in here, but I mean, this sort of... Is there a sense of trust between the consumers and the utilities? Because I think studies in the past have shown that that's been hard for the utilities.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that our research really raises in relationship to that is why we don't really like that concept of social license as a way of thinking about this necessarily. Largely because how do you, you know, the only way that we can kind of conceptualize a lack of social license is through opposition, right? So one of the real concerns here, and I think of what the override peak that Yolandi mentioned really points out as a problem with that, is that people might install some of these technologies, they might allow some forms of automation into their home, you know, because there are some reasonable incentives, or it, you know, seems like a, you know, a reasonable investment, or, you know, an interesting new technology. But if it doesn't fit into kind of their everyday life routines, priorities, and also these kind of exceptional circumstances that might happen into the future, they likely to, you know, use those technologies in ways that the energy sector maybe is not envisioning or maybe not intending. So like the override, for example. And, you know, and we asked people about this. So we also did some survey work, both through the, you know, the ECBS, the Energy Consumers Australia Behavior Survey, and also in some other work we did with City Power, Power Core, and United Energy customers. And we found that, you know, people were, you know, a reasonable number of people were willing for some smart appliances and some automation in their home, but they, the majority wanted to be able to have that override function. So this is a, you know, a case where we think of social license of people accepting these technologies, potentially allowing, signing up to them, but they'll always want that ability to override. So when we think these, the ways these technologies actually integrate into our social lives, that we might find these really unexpected negative outcomes for the grid.
And so, you know, accepting change is always a hard thing for all of us all the time. And when I read a little bit about social license, it started out with acceptance, and then it became understanding and welcoming, and finally trust in the ideal situation. But I guess, you know, if you look at change, let's take the introduction of the motor car. I mean, in the end, it can't work with every individual doing what they want. You have to have some kind of social agreement, don't you? And it's quite a complicated when we look at society these days. There are so many subgroups of people and so many voice, and in each subgroup an individual voice tends to emerge, which and I mean, how do you work out as a person who to trust? And if on the other hand you're an organization that's trying to earn trust, how do you go about getting that?
Well, one of the things that, you know, we really emphasize in, you know, the outcomes of our research is that there's a huge opportunity for co-designing, for working with people, with energy consumers, with households, what they value and how they use these technologies. And that, so actually there's huge opportunities there. It's just the approach of getting people to accept what we want to do as an energy sector is the wrong way to look at it. We need to think about how can we actually design an energy future that takes into account everyone's different priorities, that enables a strong buy-in and strong engagement with those priorities of both the energy sector, the energy transition, but also everyday households.
So speaking as a capitalist, I would say that markets are a way of doing that, but I don't intend to pursue that line of conversation here.
Well, a third of our households don't know what their energy tariff they're on, right? So something as simple as using price signals to change energy behavior is not that simple, because people don't relate to energy in that way. They don't see it as a market. They see it as part of a sort of broader community. And people, you know, really have a very different understanding of energy than just seeing it as a market. And that's in some ways, that's a challenge. And that's one of the issues with using, you know, market-based incentives, is that we actually need to broaden our thinking around the energy transition.
Yeah. Once, when I first moved to Sydney, you used to have to go out and put money in the meter to make the gas turn on. And I think I understood that incentive fairly well. Perhaps we should have, and I've seen in the past, and I'm only joking here, great big dials on the kitchen wall showing what the electricity cost is at this second. But I do agree, a lot of people just don't care what the electricity price is. But I will still bet that as a statistical prediction, that if you change tariffs, behaviour will, on average, change one way or another. But I want to come to the broader issue, I guess, just from the individual household to this process of change. I mean, you can't really keep everyone happy, can you? I mean, if there is, say, a national imperative to decarbonize, don't you just need to have a central agency that can somehow explain that to everyone and show how their own interest needs to be fit in with the national sort of thing. I mean, I think it's very interesting culturally, because in some societies, from what I have read, there seems to be a much more national and collective approach to things, as opposed to, you know, the primacy of the individual that underlies our society. But maybe this is too far off topic.
One of the things that I would add that I think, you know, supports that case really is that we don't have a very strong sort of national sort of argument or accepted sort of narrative around the energy transition. So there are, and that's one of the things I quite liked about the Dyer report, was he really called for this sort of need for a stronger narrative in community engagement that kind of goes both ways, though. He said we need to ensure communities are actively engaged in shaping and benefiting from the transition, but this has to be reciprocal, right? We also need to make sure that we understand the ways in which that communities have a role, not just government, in negotiating this narrative around the transition. And, you know, our research actually supports, I think, you know, what you're saying, is that if we do have a strong enough kind of moral or ethical imperative to transition, and we have a clear narrative around that, people are actually quite willing to change how they use energy without smart appliances, without having to rely on automation. So we asked people, you know, about if they'd be willing to respond to sort of demand management programs. And, you know, people were willing to, once we explained what they were, explained the sort of challenges for the grid and the need to have demand management, majority of people were willing to, you know, participate even without any financial incentive. So that's, you know, a huge kind of, I think, piece of evidence that supports this idea that, you know, ethics and a sort of moral community imperative for the energy transition is actually an incredibly important part of motivating people. And we don't need to rely fully on automation. So there's other ways of appealing to people.
Yeah, so the moral imperative, as John Hare used to put it, was just another way of saying you should do what I say you should, because it's a moral kind of thing. But I get it. There is a morality that underlies all of this stuff. But if I go from the household to what I personally interests me very much, which is how to you can put it in a lot of different ways, but I would say, I will just put it as simply as saying, have regional communities accept or embrace, hopefully, the what I see as the opportunities that, you know, the investment in wind and solar in their regions brings to those communities. And I see that in regional groups, there are often like little associations, and there are one or two strong people, alpha people, for want of another, or people who lead the discussion. How do you, you know, what does academic research have to say about how this conversation should be managed? I mean, obviously we should engage as early as possible. I mean, that's like a motherhood statement, but going beyond that, what happens? I mean, if we've moved beyond that and we didn't engage as early as possible, what's the next step?
I think we can also take a step back and, I mean, yes, okay, we've got to engage people early as often. I get that that's kind of a bit of a motherhood statement. But where I think communities are feeling quite disillusioned and disempowered is that they haven't been part of a conversation from the beginning that even involves them in how any of these decisions have been made about, you know, where to place renewable energy transmission lines, how to even go about, you know, moving energy across the country. And so they've sort of been brought in. I think a lot of people feel like they've been brought into this conversation really late and are just being asked to accept a decision that has already been made on their behalf. And that's where it becomes really tricky to get community engagement because they just feel like they've already been sidelined from this issue. Now, it's really tricky with something like transmission infrastructure and renewable energy, because obviously there's a whole lot of engineering and geographical parameters in there that mean you can't just, you know, put it in a different spot or do it in a different way. So I get why, you know, it's, you know, the decisions have been made and then communities have been involved. But somehow we have to get past that idea that communities just have, as a, you know, they're just involved at the end, that they're just kind of part of a discussion around accepting this thing to happen, rather than being involved in a bigger dialogue around the energy transition, what it involves, what it's going to mean for them, how they're going to, you know, be engaged in all of it. Now, when it comes to something like all the things that people are being asked to do at the household level, there is a lot more there's a lot more options that aren't being considered and that people say they're interested in that go beyond tariffs or just, you know, getting some new technology. You know, one of the key, as Kerry was saying, one of the key ways that people are interested in being engaged is through community programs, like sharing their energy with others or doing things for some kind of common good and having the grid positioned in a very different way as something, as an asset that we all kind of contribute to and manage. But that is not the way that the conversation's being framed at the moment, and it's not the way that people are being asked to participate. So this is, I guess this gets back as well to the crux of why we're concerned about the social license concept, because it really limits our understanding of what's possible to that end part of all of the transition, where it's just about getting people to agree to things that have already been decided and maybe massaging that around the edges, rather than bringing them in from the conversation from the beginning, and also really taking seriously some of the ways that people want to be part of the transition that aren't even on the table at the moment in terms of ideas and possibilities.
Well, so I agree with that, and yet I grew up in the country where people were big on co-ops and stuff. And, you know, even when I was at university, we had a co-op fruit and vegetable kind of thing for a little while. But then you know, most of us ended up finding out that actually it was a lot of work, and it was better just to let the system kind of produce a more of what I regard as equally effective, and that's an understatement, way of distributing goods and services. There are always lots of alternatives, but I still don't get a sense of really how to proceed forward. Like, if you know, for me, there's kind of the cycle. I realized this on the weekend talking to someone, that there's still this massive disconnect. There's still a lot of people that just don't understand how wind and solar can actually run an electricity grid. They just don't think what happens when the wind doesn't blow, etc., etc. I guess I'm interested in how to reframe the national conversation in a way that everyone can understand it, and then it leads down to what takes place in a particular community and how the costs and benefits are kind of shared.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's really what our research has been trying to contribute to for a long time now, David. And I think there's a couple of crucial things that I would say are really important. Kerry's already alluded to one of them, which is changing the kind of national conversation we have. We did a piece of work a while ago on engaging consumers towards the future grid. It was more household focused and regional community focused. But, you know, the central thing people told us there was that they wanted to understand the vision for the energy transition, and they wanted a central body that was going to help them understand that, a central trusted body. They were completely confused by the, you know, amount of information coming out from a number of different agencies, not really sure who to trust or who to listen to within all of that. And it didn't feel like there was a central vision or voice from anyone about where Australia was going and why they were being asked to do a lot of things. So I think that, you know, and that's come through in the Dyer report recently as well, as being, you know, really, really needed. But the other aspect is, you know, for a long time now, there's been a lot of social research coming up with new programs, new initiatives, different ways of engaging people. It's like so much research on this. And there is an opportunity here for energy utilities to take that up and design programs around all the things that people are saying they want, and that, you know, the ways that they want to be engaged in the system. So I think there's actually a lot of material there that can be implemented right now to help with some of these issues, both at that big scale in terms of the vision and the trust, and also in just implementing things that people say they want.
Yeah, I'd agree that there's actually quite a hunger for community energy and for communities to sort of learn how they can actually contribute and work together to achieve some of these things. You know, if you just think about our original utilities, they were very much sort of community-owned or locally owned and locally focused, and the same thing still exists to a certain extent in many European countries. And Anne, who you met earlier and just in preparation for this sort of podcast, and who hosts our Switched On podcast, was chairing a session at the Community Energy Congress, which was held upstairs from the Smart Energy Council conference in Sydney last week. And there was quite a few people there, sort of well over 100 to 200 in times. But as far as she could tell, there was basically no one there from the big utilities, from the energy industry itself. It was a whole bunch of community members sort of sitting together trying to work out what they can do. But there just seemed to be this sort of nexus, this sort of distance between the community who want to do something and the industry that could actually help them. Does this sort of reflect a common problem?
Well, I mean, we're probably not the best to comment on that because the partners we've been working with have been super engaged and have actually been really, you know, really embracing this research and trying to figure out how to implement it within their own, you know, their own businesses and operations. And so I do think that there is some change occurring. We haven't had a lot to do in terms of partnering with retailers at this stage, so I can't really comment on, you know, where they're at. And I know that they do, you know, they do implement a lot of these programs. But there is, I think that there is a growing awareness within the industry that everyone has to kind of get better at understanding consumer expectations and also just recognising how important consumers are going to be to realising all of these energy ambitions we all have, not just, you know, from transmission infrastructure through to getting people to agree to have something automated in their home.
Yeah, I guess it comes back to also information and understanding too. And Karen, maybe I can come back to you now, because David joked earlier on, you said he was joking about putting money in the machine in the meter to keep the gas going or electricity going, and sort of joked about having sort of large screens in people's homes to show how much they're using. But I actually think that's a really, really good idea. And I did a recent trip to the UK to sort of visit some long lost relatives, and every single one of them had these big screens quite prominently displayed in their kitchen showing exactly how much electricity they were using. There was one quite well-to-do family in London who couldn't really give a toss, and they were certainly using a lot, and there was others who were very conscious about how much they were using, and to the extent that when we plugged in our electric vehicle, the lady of the household had to stand in front of the screen to sort of hide the fact that it had gone into red from the husband, who was obsessed about keeping it down. But that'd be a good idea, wouldn't it? Because, I mean, you commented before that it's a lack of information, and it's true, people just don't understand what they're using, or even some of the things like their rooftop solar now or their batteries actually do and perform, and how they contribute to the grid and how it actually eases their bills. More information, more understanding of how that happens on almost like a minute or hourly basis will, you know, create that understanding and give people a basis on which to make further decisions.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the most interesting aspects of the research is we do research with a wide variety of different households, right? So we have some households who keep perfect records. One guy who has 10 years of records where he wrote down the exact daily amount that his solar's produced, and kept it, you know, in an Excel spreadsheet that he entered into at 5 p.m. every day, right? All the way to people
who... That's not going to catch on.
All the way to people who, you know, don't pay any attention at all to what their solar is doing, or, you know, so, or don't have it or understand how it works, or, you know, a lot of people who don't have access to it because they're low-income renters, right? So we also think a lot about people who are left out of the transition in that way. But by having this wide variety of things, we see that there are actually a lot of different ways that people relate to their energy, and particularly the way that they think about it and monitor it. So a lot of people, one finding is when they first get solar panels, you know, they'll get a sort of app and they spend a bit of time looking at that, interested in the energy data but then usually within a week or two, they, that don't update the app, stop paying attention to it. And what they do instead is they develop new sort of habits and routines. So they don't look at an energy monitor necessarily, but they look out the window to see if the sun is shining. Right. And so it's much more about finding ways in which we can appeal to our kind of everyday ways that we inhabit our space, everyday ways that we learn and understand and relate to energy, which is a much more, look out the window kind of way than it is necessarily having an energy data monitor in your house. But for some people, that is great, right? Some people are really interested in that. So it's not a sort of one size fits all approach, but it's, trying some different messagings around kind of how we might be able to spread that information. And like you mentioned, we also have I was going to say, we also have a bit of a challenge when it comes to, you know, the way there's often a sort of energy manager in the household. So one person maybe who's particularly interested in the energy, but often the people who use make most of the energy decisions, you know, when to run the dishwasher, when to do the laundry, are often not that same person, right? So we have a lot of kind of lack of communication even within the household, lack of understanding even within the household about, you know, the difference between that kind of technology-focused perspective on the energy and then sort of everyday life of just getting through the day in the most convenient way.
Well, you know, the same analogy goes with water, basically, which is just something that people take for granted. But most Australians now have a culture where they understand that when there's a drought on, you can put a water restriction on, and there's very little community argument about it. And when you have petrol, which is another thing, people see the price every time they fill up their tank, so they're very conscious of their petrol cost. I don't know what the answer is with electricity. I don't believe the expense of putting big meters in every house is necessarily going to make households better. And as you say, there's a lot of renters and people these days who don't necessarily want to have all those costs. And it's an interesting conversation, but I'm just not sure that we're making progress towards the goal of getting people to accept that if we want to live in a world, if we want our descendants to, and everyone else's descendants to live in a decent world, then we need to get a lot done in a real hurry.
I'd like to actually sort of maybe sort of finish off by asking sort of Kerry and Yolande to maybe sort of, you know, offer some suggestions. But first, I'd just like to make the observation that the fact that more people are going electric with electric vehicles and they're thinking more about their electricity usage and their consumption more often, I guess that's sort of kind of helping, and it will continue to help. Maybe we can just sort of finish off with you guys just sort of saying it and trying to answer that David's question about, you know, what it is that you would recommend, or some of the things that some of the initiatives that could be taken to try and sort of resolve or bring this issue to the forefront. Maybe start with you, Kerry.
Sure. One of the things that really comes to mind is this, the inequalities in the energy transition. I mean, a lot of people feel very, very left out of the transition because they don't have access to these technologies, because they're renter, because they're lower income. So they don't necessarily have access to producing electricity at their house, but they do have load, right? So a lot of them are interested in ways that they can potentially take part in the energy transition through forms of demand management. So I think presenting, you know, creating maybe and opening our minds up to different ways that we might use the challenges of the renewable transition and shift them into opportunities, to think about the sort of incredible abundance of solar electricity that we have, not as a problem, but as an opportunity, and as a way of bringing others into the energy transition.
Yolande?
Yeah, so I would probably just emphasize two things that we've sort of touched on today. One is actually what you were saying, David, about kind of what's been happening with water and our understanding of water as something that we just conserve because it's a precious resource. And I think there's an opportunity to think about how we frame energy in that way as well. So at the moment, the push is to frame it as a market commodity, much more like petrol, whereas I think the opportunities for demand management and for the transition are much higher if we think about it as that, you know, essential resource, that common good resource that many people still see as being important in relation to our energy system. So that's the kind of reframing, I guess, of how we approach strategies and initiatives around energy with people. And the other is that for most people, they're not thinking about energy when they're using energy, right? This is obvious, but I think it's a point that often gets lost. They're using it to, you know, get comfortable, get the washing done, get clean, whatever it might be. And it's those values and those practices that our research shows where a lot of the demand management opportunities actually lie. So at the moment, there's a big transition going on in Australian homes around households wanting not just comfortable air in their home, but safe and healthy air as well, purchasing air purifiers, for example, changing the whole way that they manage air flows through their home. And increasingly, we're seeing the integration of air purification into air conditioning systems, all of which could have significant demand load implications. Now, pricing and, you know, all the conventional ways of trying to get people to think about energy, giving them data, whatever, isn't really going to help with that, because people want that value of healthy, safe and comfortable air. So the answers are going to lie in how else we can provide that for people, and also working with health practitioners around what actually is recommended, not about energy consumption, but about how you maintain a healthy home environment. Like, do you actually need to run the air conditioner and the air purifier and shuttle the windows? When do you need to do that? In what circumstances? That's the kind of information that I think would be really powerful. It's not, it's kind of has an indirect tangential kind of benefit to energy consumption, but it's the kind of thing that people are actually interested in and driving them towards making decisions around energy right now.
And I guess it just prompts one final question from me. I mean, you're sort of talking about sort of the information and a different way of approaching. Is this an opportunity for a different sort of service provider other than a traditional utility to kind of enter the home and sort of engage with those things? I mean, we do see new competition and they've got different business models. A lot of it's about sort of making money and sort of fast response and using your battery. But is there an opportunity for people to sort of come in with the approach that you've kind of discussed here?
Well, absolutely. But I also think there's an approach for energy utilities to rethink how it is that they're actually trying to engage people. And rather than thinking about how do we get people to care about their energy bills or pay attention to tariffs, thinking about how the energy sector partners with the health sector to improve some of these outcomes for people and achieve the load objectives at the same time. So I don't know that we need necessarily new players. I think we just need to change our approach as an energy sector to how we're engaging people.
The whole point of having retailers competition is that retailers can come in with any perspectives that they like, as opposed to the wires and poles companies that are regulated monopolies that are interested in all of these things but don't actually directly engage with the consumer. And what retailers have always found or always tried to do is that the only thing they ever sell on is price and possibly whether the energy is green or not. As far as I know, there's no retailer that really sells on any other basis other than the fact that they will be there so that, you know, the quality thing that they offer to their customers, that they will be there even if some local retailer startup goes broke and they offer a lower price. So I think there's a long way to go, but I mean, speaking as someone that looks at research from a descriptive attitude as much as normative, the fact that retailers all adopt this approach says that they must believe that it's price that influences consumers to change rather than other qualities. But I do think we have to improve and go forward. I'd like to say thanks very much. I'm actually very interested in community concepts and community acceptance. And, you know, I found on the weekend that I still think people don't understand fully, or they have a psychological block to the fact that wind and solar can actually run the electricity system. And I think the national messaging needs to start there with more respect given to the work that the integrated AEMO does with the integrated system plan and work down. And but at the same time, I'm talking too much. We have an opposition party that is determined to try and make our community's acceptance as difficult as possible. So there we are. Thanks very much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Landy. Thank you, Kerry. And it's been great to get your perspective. And that was Yolanda Strengers, and Kerry Dahlgren from Monash University and the Emerging Technologies Research Lab. Look, some interesting things there, David. I'm particularly struck on the ability of the major utilities to come inside the home and make themselves wanted and trusted, particularly as this electrification of households increases and we've got EVs and batteries and rooftop solar and we've got demand management and virtual power plants, and that basically sort of hands over sort of, you know, some of the power over the control over those things inevitably to those utilities. So it's going to be an interesting challenge, one in actually making that happen. The early adopters and the techno freaks will love it, but getting in there to the rest of the community, I think, is going to be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, I'm a great fan of using price as a signal rather than compelling people to do things. That's point one. And point two is that another thing that's byproduct of what we've done in Australia, which is to follow the British model of deregulation, which is to separate out the monopoly wires and poles from the competitive retailers and generators, and we regulate the wires and poles. That's what the Australian Energy Regulator primarily does. Is that we've got this duplication and separation between the household. The household physical electricity stuff is done by the network, but the interaction is, in a sense, with the retailer. And the retailer can really distort whatever the network company's doing in a lot of ways. And you have to maintain two sets of IT, you know, two sets of customer records, and what the network might is good for the network may not necessarily be good for the retailer, and vice versa, and neither of them may be very good for the householder. So there's you know, I think the whole model, I've been saying this for years, it could do with some more fundamental rethink and justification again.
Yes, that's just what we're really up for is another inquiry into the sort of the structure of the energy markets. But you're right. I mean, that the current model that we do have, the separation of the networks from the retailers and the generators, has created certain issues which are becoming problematic now. And look, and just sort of vaguely related to that, Anne Delaney over at the Switched On podcast, doing some great stuff on electrification. She had a really interesting interview in last week's podcast about the issue with embedded networks. And basically, these are sort of the things that are sort of which are built into, say, new apartment blocks and housing sort of housing developments, and everyone's sort of on the network, and it's and a lot of people, there's very little protection for them, and this is where a lot of people are moving.
It's hard to
opt out.
It's
very hard to opt out, and they're not being fairly treated, and there are some major issues there. It's a really quite a striking story. And I'd ask people to have a look out for that. David, I'm not too sure what else there is in the news. I would note a couple of big battery developments happening around the place. Western Australia, the Synergy, the state-owned retailer, is started construction on, I guess, what will be the biggest battery, at least for a time, in Collie. That's 500 megawatts and 2,000 megawatt hours. So that's pretty big. In terms of storage, designed specifically to help shift rooftop solar from the midday hours to the evening, and particularly needed as the forecast, well, we'll see when the that local energy electricity statement of opportunities comes out in a few months, but it seems like they're now anticipating that the largest private coal unit there, Blue Waters, which has been having all sorts of problems with its coal supply and its financials, is now expected to close in 2026. So that's, and there's another big battery storage tender going on there for more of this sort of capacity to sort of shift the solar into the evening peak, which is the main challenge in the WA grid, which is an isolated grid and a really interesting case study in the transition to renewables. And talking about that, South Australia, which kind of leads the world because it's got 70% renewables already, is just started construction of another new battery, this time by Zen Energy. This is a battery called the Templars. Battery is about 117 megawatts, if I remember rightly, in about 2.5 hour storage just north of Adelaide. So along with the Blythe battery and a couple of the other ones being built in South Australia, it's probably going to take the number of big batteries in that state to about 10. So it's interesting to note that as you get into high levels of renewables, wind and solar, I think it's averaged 70% over the last 12 months. Fast track target now to 100%. You're starting to see that level of storage really being ramped up now. Which is
and this is the thing. It was only a couple of years ago that we were talking about batteries being subsidized all the time, things generally happen faster at certain stages of these transitions, and we go into these exponential growth curves, and that's what's happening with batteries in Australia right now for stationary storage, where I think we've got something like 5 gigawatts already under construction one way or another, plus a couple more that we know are going to get there, like that one in the Northern Rivers, once it gets a grid connection license and actually some planning approvals. It's got an LTESA, but it needs a few other bits and pieces. The other thing, speaking of the grid, that I think is really interesting is that we've seen these two inquiries into, say, HumeLink, where we've talked about You know, essentially the debate has gone on about underground in versus above ground in. But the fact is that with the exception perhaps of Queensland, we've really built very little transmission in Australia in the last 20 years because it's been so difficult to get it approved. So I've got a whole group of younger engineers that are going to have learning how to actually get it done. And meanwhile, in the United States and places, there's been a lot of innovation in above ground transmission. So three ideas that have been drawn to my attention recently that I think are very interesting, and that's the idea of a monopole. So you just have a big pole instead of a lattice. You need a bit more concrete in the foundation, but you know, that instantly you can get a tractor closer, you know, less to avoid. The second thing is an incredibly simple but nevertheless very interesting idea that the Army first taught us about it, and that is that you can camouflage these poles by painting them the same colour as the background. That might sound really stupid, but I think it actually has the effect of it could easily make them less visually displeasing, as particularly when you're looking up at them instead of looking down on them, or maybe it's the other way around. And the third thing is that, and there was a story in Renew Economy about this, and it's one I'm going to follow through in another section, is this idea of these new conductors like carbon fiber wrapped in aluminium as opposed to, or steel, as opposed to having had the traditional aluminium. And what these carbon fiber can do is they don't sag as much, so you can actually have less poles. And one argument is you can have probably half as many transmission towers as you would need in the existing ones. And also for a given sort of cable, they can carry more electricity because they get less sag in them as well. So that together with other things like we were talking about for dynamic transmission line rating, so because it's when it's windy, it's cool actually, so if you've got a wind-based system, you can probably carry a lot more power than in a hot coal-based system which suffers in the sun. There's actually a lot of life left in above-ground transmission that can, I think, make its environmental impacts and its costs better than they look today once we start to get into it, like in other areas of this transition. That's another long burst.
It is, but it was very entertaining, Dave. I enjoyed it. Yes, and look, even on the opposite end of that sort of spectrum, there's a new proposal coming from the transmission company Victoria Power Corp, which is a network company, which is talking about sort of taking sort of more towns in various parts of the grid which are exposed at risk of bushfires completely off the grid, and creating sort of standalone microgrids just to sort of boost resilience and presumably reduce costs. So interesting things happening. I mean, I guess like with the whole of the energy transition, so many different ideas and conflicting forces and things like that, and sort of trying to manage your way through it is not an easy challenge. David, look, I think we've been rattling on for long enough. I think that's probably enough for this week, unless you've got something urgent to share with the...
Giles, when you talked about conflicting forces, I thought you were going to take me back to John Pritchard and Kurt Lewin's force field theory, but perhaps we'll just stick with an acknowledgement of our wonderful sponsors.
That's a safe thing to do then. I'd like to thank Pylon and Evergen for their continuing and ongoing support of this podcast. And as mentioned before, check out the Switched On podcast. Fascinating story about embedded networks, and also a really good interview on the Solar Insiders podcast with Stan Kirpan from Solar Victoria, talking about their sort of success and their trials with different sorts of price encouragements for home batteries, heat pumps, and rooftop solar. So really interesting stuff. So that's it from us. Thanks very much to Yolanda and Carrie for joining us on this episode of the Energy Insiders podcast. Thanks to you, David. Thanks to everybody out there. And we'll be back again next week. Bye for now.
Energy Insiders was brought to you by Evergen, the market-leading renewable energy software business that optimises residential and commercial solar and battery systems. Evergen enables large numbers of systems to operate as a single fleet, so network operators can use them as a virtual power plant, generating significant value for consumers, network operators, and the energy system as a whole. Evergen software is powering the energy system of the future. Energy Insiders was also brought to you by Pylon. Pylon provides easy-to-use solar design software for installers and retailers with pay-as-you-go pricing, no monthly cost, and no lock-in contracts. Join Australia's top solar companies who trust Pylon to design high-resolution, CEC-ready solar proposals.